This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Sexy and Surreal, a David Lynch and David Cronenberg podcast. I'm Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Terry Menard. Hi, Terry.
Hey, Joe. I have a question. Do you want a snakeskin jacket? Because I do hear that it is a symbol of individuality and a belief in personal freedom.
Right. Yes. I'm actually good. I don't think I can wear it any better than Nicolas Cage in this film, because aside from some hair issues, this was hot Nicolas Cage.
It sure was. There's a lot of shots where I was just like respectfully admiring the goods. But yeah, no, he's looking good in this movie.
Yes, he and Laura Dern both are quite hot, and there's some very aggressive sex scenes. Folks, we have not said what we're talking about, so welcome back. We are returning from our brief hiatus to continue our exploration of the careers of David Lynch and David Cronenberg. We're on the Lynch side of the podcast, and we're talking about 1990's Wild at Heart.
And what a wild movie this is. I was not... Truly. You had never seen this before either, right?
No, this was a first-time watch for me. I've been eagerly anticipating this because I knew that it was a beloved favorite for a lot of Lynch fans. But I gotta say, this both feels like Lynch and also doesn't at the same time.
Yes. When I was doing a little bit of cursory research about the kind of production for this, there was a moment where Lynch was talking about how he thought this might be a little too mainstream, and so kind of went back and retooled some stuff, or like, I think it was before they were even maybe filming, that he was afraid that it was going to be a little bit too mainstream, and so they retooled a little bit of it.
Right.
And I do think that this is a movie, I think kind of befitting the fact that it is a very unruly and kind of twisty movie, just that the production design behind it is also similarly a little fly by the seat of your pants, because it sounded as if like we had a story that was more faithful to the book towards the end, and then Lynch added some more stuff as he went along. Nicolas Cage brought in the stunning snakeskin jacket, and then that got written into the script. Like, it just feels like the script was almost being unspooled in real time in some ways.
Yeah. So this is based on a novel of the same name by Barry Gifford. He, of course, also wrote a Perdita Durango book called 59 Degrees and Raining, the story of Perdita Durango, who is a minor character in the film. Folks, I will definitely recommend that Alex de la Iglesia film, although even though it feels like it's a companion piece to this, because it's, you know, sexually active lovers on the run, committing crimes, getting into trouble, and so on. That film, I think, is far more aggressive than this movie, like very confronting. But I was not surprised to discover that Barry Gifford was involved in both. Like, you can see the similarities, but you're right, Terry. You know, the Elvis stuff and also the Wizard of Oz stuff is Lynch additions, as well as the happy ending for our couple, Sailor, as well as Lula. But, this has the hallmarks of Lynch, and yet it also feels like he's in experimentation mode, right? You can tell he wants to do something a little bit different from Twin Peaks, which he had just finished filming the pilot of. And I don't know. Like, I almost don't even know what to say about the movie, because it does feel so episodic. And I wonder if that's the kind of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants feel that we're getting from the overall film.
I was wondering the same thing, because I can definitely, this definitely feels as if like Lynch working past the at least the pilot of Twin Peaks and working on creating something. And it's weird, because there's also a lot of overlap with Twin Peaks. Like there's some choice music in here.
Oh yeah.
By his favorite collaborator, composer. And I cannot remember what his last name is.
Is it Angelo Badalamenti?
Yes. So, yes, Angelo Badalamenti returns for this to, of course, create the sonic score. And there's a lot of refrains in here that felt as if like it was tied to Twin Peaks. There's like a little bit of that sort of subtle jazz or that bluesy kind of thing, that kind of bluesy number that we would get when Cheryl Lane's character would come on screen, and it was like this doom, 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 doom.
Yeah.
And that continues in here. But then also, we also see the score kind of playing with a little bit of heavy rock and some industrial stuff. And so I liked what you said earlier about how this feels like Lynch in an experimental form, because having not seen Lost Highway, this feels almost like a primer into Lost Highway, because we're dealing with rock music that I know becomes like a theme in Lost Highway. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with like road trip kind of movies. We're dealing with this idea of being stuck on a lost, almost like a Lost Highway in this movie. Mm-hmm. And so like, I feel as if this is another one of those times where he's like trying with things. And maybe this is I don't want to use the word failure, but maybe this is like him trying to test out. And then from what I understand, Lost Highway being more of a fully fledged movie from that. Again, not having seen Lost Highway, I'm just inferring based on kind of what I'm gathering from this film.
Right. I mean, one of the things that you're also probably picking up on is that this film has a bit of a troubled history in terms of its reception, right? So,
oh yeah,
it infamously won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and then it was summarily booed. You know, Roger Ebert fucking hated this movie because he hates most of Lynch's early works. And it wasn't a box office success, and it wasn't critically accepted in the same way that Blue Velvet was, even though when you look at Blue Velvet and this film, they do feel like they're in conversation with one another, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
Blue Velvet is a smaller film in terms of the geography and what it's looking at, but there's very much a condemnation of Americana. And in this case, as you said, we've got this road trip movie that looks like it's expanding beyond on the confines of Blue Velvet, but it's doing it in a slightly messier, less socially acceptable way. Like, this is veering into exploitation films at times. It's got a bit of that film noir underbelly that we're hearing both in the music, but also the litany of assassins. But, you know, that it's also got the quirky trademark Lynch characters. Like, there's some really big performances in this film.
There sure are. But I want to go back to one thing that you just said, because it, like, I'll be honest, after I was done watching this movie, I was like, I don't really know what to think about this film. And so I was like,
it's a hard first watch, I think.
It really is. And I was going into this conversation with little, not concerned, but like, I don't really know how to really talk about this film. But I think you nailed it on the head with this film being in conversation with Blue Velvet. And if you think about this film being in conversation with Blue Velvet and to an extent, Twin Peaks is the pilot episode where we are focusing on small town Americana and the corruption lying within. This almost takes like a bigger approach, because now we're leaving small town Americana. We're going across country, and we are seeing that things are not good in
anywhere.
This world.
No.
And I think there's a lot of really great ideas in this film. I'm not sure if the execution 100% works for me, but one of the things that I really did like, and it ties into this conversation, is the moment when Laura Dern's Lula, great name by the way, is driving the car as Sailor, Nicolas Cage's Sailor, is lounging in the back seat. And she is turning the radio and she's trying to find something to like lose herself to. And it's all news about horrible things. We're talking divorce. We're talking about people getting murdered. We're talking about high crimes. We're talking about all of these horrible things as she is switching channels. She cannot find music. And all she wants to do is find music, something to kind of drone that out. And I was like, this feels a bit bigger in scope in terms of like Blue Velvet, where we're focusing on small town Americana, where this is saying, yeah, that corruption has spread across America.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that you reference that scene, because when I was doing some research, I found a Guardian article that was celebrating, I think, the film's 30th anniversary. And the writer of the piece singled out that particular moment. So the part where she's driving the car, and then when they find music by Power Mad, which is the heavy metal rock band that they attend the concert of, and then they listen to on the radio, and they do their kind of like full on mosh pit style dancing on the side of the road. And this Guardian article really highlighted that as emblematic of the larger film, right? You know, it's about these two lovers whose affection and romance will overcome all of the atrocities, all the madness, all of the violence in the world. as long as they stick together. And I do think that's why it's so important that Lynch ultimately changes the end of Gifford's book, because the end of the book, they actually split up, and it's a bit more of a, I don't think a fatalistic ending, but it's, you know, love does not conquer the day. Whereas so much of this film has that optimism that if Lula and Sailor can stick together and overcome all of this, then at least there's some hope left in the world.
This movie feels very out of character, like, right? Optimistic wise for everything that we've seen up until this point. Because, like, I mean, you know, Eraserhead is not optimistic.
It's dour. Yeah.
It's very dour. Elephant Man. I found myself, like, feeling very sad by the end of that movie, just because of the way in which Merrick was treated. We have Blue Velvet, which is, I feel very kind of nihilistic in some ways.
Oh,
Twin
sure.
Peaks.
Yeah.
Like, we've dealt with a whole lot of nihilism and a whole lot of hopelessness in movies. And then to find this movie that is trying to focus on this idea of hope, an idea of making things better by the end of the film by sticking, as you said, sticking together. That was like a tonal shock for me coming from his work.
Which is funny because I think that does inherently make the project more commercial. I also can't help but wonder if that's why the legacy of the film, you know, I said it had a bit of that troubled production. We didn't really go into it, but as you hinted, this was shot relatively quickly. You know, like, we got the film rights and then we had to make it very quickly after shooting the pilot for Twin Peaks. And I can't help but wonder if part of the reason that people didn't like this film initially, in addition to issues that people had with the violence back in 1990, I can't help but wonder if people were looking for something from Lynch and he said, ooh, I'm going to give you a little bit of romance and hopeful optimism. And they said, ooh, is this artiste selling out? Mm. But I wonder if now, after all of these years, we've had time to process and sort of accept the film for what it is, and we're actually responding more to that level of optimism and hope and romance in the work of a person that we never really expected that from.
I was thinking as you were talking about, like, the timelines for this, that some of it might have also been the fact that, you know, he comes out swinging with the pilot episode of Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. And then we have this, and people were like, wait, this is not like the thing you just created.
Yeah.
And when you consider the fact that, you know, we have the 1-2 punch of Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, and then now we have this, it is a whole lot different than those two properties. So I'm like,
oh, sure.
I do think that maybe with that separation, it's easier. It might be easier to have like a recontextualization of this film in terms of what it's trying to say. But I also, for me, this might be a movie that I need to watch like multiple times to like fully appreciate.
Yeah.
But for me, it does feel a little thrown together at the last minute. And some of the additions to its work, I like the idea. And I think we'll talk about this a little bit more as we talk about kind of the themes that it's exploring. But I like the idea of using Elvis Presley, but I'm not 100% sure that the Wizard of Oz has been shoehorned in appropriately.
Yeah, it totally makes sense to me thematically. Like, especially when I read about it, I thought, oh, that's going to be really interesting. I'm excited to see how he puts it together. But I feel the exact same way. The Elvis stuff totally worked for me. The Wizard of Oz stuff felt very awkward. Like, it didn't feel organic, to the point where there were moments late in the film, like after the near rape scene of Lula by Bobby Peru, played by an Oscar-nominated Willem Dafoe, when she clicks her red high heel shoes after that interaction, I audibly groaned because I was just like, no, it's not working for me here.
It's very on the nose in a way that Lynch has never been.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it's spelling things out for stupid people, and I didn't like it.
No, and like, I think there's something to be said about the use of Elvis and Wizard of Oz in a contemporary, well, you know, 1990s contemporary for that time, movie about hopelessness and about America. Because if you do look at the way in which things have changed from when Wizard of Oz came out, and sort of like this idea of like hope and like fantasy and otherworldliness that is like positive.
Yeah.
And then we also have like the crooning sounds of Elvis, who kind of defined an era of music and also of a nostalgic bent that we look back at. Some people, I don't, but some people look back at like the 1950s.
Yes.
And so when you put those and you juxtapose that with the nihilism of the early 90s, because if we look at like this decade, we have moved, we're moving from the kind of popcorn, big haired bands, kind of poppy synthetic music of the 80s. And we're turning into more, we're going into grunge, we're going into industrial, we're going into, on the movie side, we're going to get Pulp Fiction in 4 years. We're going to get like this gritty, violent, down to earth type filmmaking. And so there's something interesting there about contrasting the Wizard of Oz and Elvis with today and asking, is this all a fantasy or is this something that we could still, you know, aspire to? Right. And so I think there's interesting things there. It just, you're right. When she clicks her heels, I was like, oh my goodness. Or like someone brings up Toto. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're getting a little heavy handed. And it felt like it got more heavy handed as the film progressed, which made me wonder if like it just started getting added in as we were filming.
Yeah. It's definitely an execution thing. Cause even as you were expanding on the idea verbally, I thought to myself, this does work, right? It's the idea of fantasy. It's about being nostalgic. It's about thinking, yeah, it just embodies everything that Lynch is trying to say, particularly about this couple. It's just for me, the execution isn't really there. And yeah, you know, the shoe clicking is not good. And then when Cheryl Lee shows up as the good witch in the final moments to remind Sailor not to run away from love, I just thought, oh God, what are we doing? You know, it does feel like Lynch is almost succumbing to something too conventional. Like he's, this doesn't feel daring to me. This feels palatable and almost safe. And I struggle with it because I do like the subversion of him not being nihilistic. Like it would have been so easy to kill Sailor and leave this movie as a bit of a Debbie Downer where all of a sudden Lula has spent her entire life waiting for this man to sing a certain Elvis song to her to confirm that he actually loves her. And instead he just ends up murdered or back in jail or she's alone with his child. And I really like that he doesn't succumb to that. I just wish it hadn't, as you said, been so heavy handed.
And I, as you were talking, I was also thinking about how we have discussed a number of times the kind of trollishness of Lynch, where he kind of zigzags where audiences expect him to go. And so I do think in some ways, looking back on this film, it is kind of funny in that this is definitely not what I would expect Lynch to follow up Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks with, is this film. And so again, there is almost a little bit of like a winkle of mischievousness in his eye as he is like doing something a little bit different, is how I, is how I was thinking about this. But yeah, it's just, As we've said, the execution, I don't think, is completely there.
It is wild, too, though, because in some regards, you know, before we hopped on the air, we said this just feels kind of out of character for Lynch, you know, and maybe this is him being playful, being subversive, zigging when the audience expects him to zag and so on. But then the film still has so many of these trademark Lynchisms, right? You know, the image of Lula's father on fire in his domestic home is, to me, tantamount to the reveal of Leland as Bob that we just talked about on Twin Peaks, episode 207, where it's just like, this is horrifying. You know, what an image about the destruction of the domestic American home. And, you know, I love that kind of replicating of symbols, and it really worked for me. And then we've got, you know, these huge personality characters. Like, I need to have a full conversation about Laura Dern's mom, Diane Ladd, as Marietta, because this fucking actress eats this movie alive, and I could not get enough of this character.
I loved her. She was giving me, I wrote my notes because I couldn't, off the top of my head, think of what her name is, but Jennifer Coolidge vibes. Like,
okay.
Some of the performance was like, over-the-top sort of...
It's so soap opera, right?
Yes. And I was thinking also about how some of the domestic scenes in this with her mom reminds me a little bit of, like, maybe what Twin Peaks would be watching on their soap opera on the television.
100%. Yeah.
But yes, I loved Diane Ladd's performance when she takes the lipstick and she almost is like she's cutting her wrists with it. And then she is painting her face red with it. It's just like, this is hilarious and weird and everything I would expect to see in a performance like this. And I loved it. I loved it so much.
Yeah, it got so over the top and melodramatic. It fully went into camp territory.
Yeah.
To the point that I was getting almost John Waters vibes from this.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh,
and I love the idea that's set against this backdrop of an American road trip movie with, you know, outlandish violence and big characters. You know, like, this movie is basically about lovers on the run from a huge number of assassins who are all kind of inept, which is wild. But then we've got this inherently almost incestuous domestic drama of a mother who wants to fuck her daughter's boyfriend and also has covered up all of this other, like, really horrifying stuff where her daughter was raped at age 13 by, you know, the dentist. And it's wild stuff.
Yeah, I was surprised at some of the directions that the flashbacks came and took us with. And I was thinking,
oh my God, Terry, we saw an abortion in this movie.
Yes. I was like sitting there and I was trying to like piece together what was happening. It's like, oh wait, no, she's getting an abortion. What the F? Like, this is but I was also thinking about how David Lynch is playing kind of with nonlinear storytelling in this movie. Because like, there's a lot of times where we get brief depictions of what happened in the past, and then we start to revisit those scenes and it fills out more of the backstory. With, like, for instance, I think the first time that it was noticeable to me is when the movie opens with a very vicious fight between a sailor and the first assassin that the mom sends after him. And then the assassin says that, you know, you basically fucked your girlfriend's mom in the bathroom. And so we're like, okay, what happened here? And later on, we get to see the scene of them in the bathroom and she is desperately trying to have sex with him. And they again going into the stall and that's all we see. And so then you're like, okay, did they have sex in there? And then a little bit later, we flash back to that a bit more and we fill out the scene. And so I think there's some interesting storytelling techniques happening here that allows us to not have someone giving us an exposition dump and does the showing instead of the telling.
Yes.
And I liked that. It felt too. It felt a little disjointed, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was all very much working for me because it felt like the characters weren't always being honest with themselves or other characters. And Lynch was using his disjointed nonlinear timelines to reveal the truth to us, the audience. So we had a better understanding of what was actually happening in this world. But it reinforced to me how the characters are all living in their own kind of fantasy.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And the things that we are sharing with people isn't always the whole truth. Like, we get this idea of, because she says that, you know, her mom never knew about what happened. But then in a kind of little funny aside, you know, a couple weeks later, he has this bad accident and she makes this comment about, like, man, all the traffic over there, I never want to drive over there. But it's obvious it probably wasn't a bad accident. It was probably them getting rid of him.
100%.
And so, like, we have that kind of stuff and we're seeing that either A, the characters don't completely know what happened, or that they're not telling the whole story because they don't want to be, maybe they don't want to be seen as horrible by the other person. And so we're like, what can I tell you and piece out my backstory as we go along?
Right.
And it worked really well for the narrative, I would say.
Yeah, the way that we tell stories either to other people or sometimes to ourselves it also really worked for me in establishing the relationship between Lula and Sailor. Like, to me, one of the most interesting moments is when Sailor tells Lula about a sexual encounter he had with a woman. Yeah. And she gets so turned on by his sort of truth-telling. Like, it becomes an almost erotic story to further their own romance, and they immediately have to leave and go fuck.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the sex, though? Because I'm not going to lie, I was not expecting to see Laura Dern's breasts so much.
No,
and that was a little confronting because, you know, Laura Dern, a queer icon. We all love her and respect her. But it's like, this is hot stuff.
It really is. The sexuality on screen, even though a lot of it doesn't show a whole lot, like we do get to see, you know, breasts, and but we never see much of him except his gorgeous hairy chest
and like bikini briefs in the one scene, which was like, okay, late 80s, there we go, love it.
I was like, that is underwear that gay people wear today.
Honestly, very revealing.
But yeah, like, it is, even though it's not as explicit as, like, I because, like, I heard that this movie was very sexual, and when you go to the IMDb, like, the ratings are severe for everything.
And violent, so I was just like, oh, I think people were maybe a little more timid in 1990.
Yes, because I was like, okay, this is not as over the top as I was kind of expecting based on, you know, research before watching the movie, and yet it's still incredibly erotic, and their chemistry, chemistry is just
really
beautiful.
Good. Yeah. I'm legitimately surprised that Laura Dern didn't get any kind of awards recognition for this. You know, I'm not at all surprised that Diane Ladd did, because that performance is so big and bold and brash. You know, it's really hard not to notice Marietta, but I think Laura Dern is doing such fucking good work. And I really enjoyed reading a little bit about why she ended up taking the role. You know, Lynch wanted her and Cage. He ended up basically propositioning them before he even finished writing the script. He read the book. He talked to them. They started developing the characters as he was working on it. So this ended up being very much a collaboration between the three. But I loved reading Laura Dern saying, I had never really had the opportunity to play such a sexually assertive, confident woman. And she's young when she makes this movie. I think she's 20. Yeah. And obviously she had worked with Lynch before in Blue Velvet. But this is such a, like, a 180 degree change from that character. And I really enjoyed seeing this sexually active, like, very in control girl. You know, I think she's naive in the ways that Lula needs to be to go on the run with this convicted criminal who's breaking his parole. But I never doubted the character because the performance is so committed.
Yes, absolutely. And I was thinking back to what you had talked about with the sex scene that Nicolas Cage is describing to Lula from a previous encounter, and how, I mean, like, he literally reaches under this woman's leg, and it's thumb and ass, hands gripping the front of her, right?
So provocative.
It's so provocative. And yet at the same time, I was like, ooh, that's really kind of, that's really hot. But I wasn't sure what the context was initially. And then when we see him kind of like telling this, the story to her, I was like, ooh, what is she, how is she going to react to this? Because a lot of times in these types of movies, there'll be jealousy, even though this is something that happened in the past. And I was like, is this going to be like a breaking point because he's talking about this sexual relation? And no, it takes it into a more sexual direction with the two of them in an interesting way that you don't get to see on film a whole lot, like the way that that whole sequence goes forward. And I was really taken aback by that. And you're right. I think that there is a lot of, there's a lot to be said about the fact that they do feel like collaborators on this, where you have to trust the director with this kind of film.
Oh,
and you can see that she is giving 130,000%. Like, it is just really good.
Yeah. I mean, there's something exciting about seeing the range that a director can bring out. And obviously, you know, we should give as much credit to Dern as Lynch for this. But I'm excited that he saw something of her potential from Blue Velvet and said, I think you can really ace this role. And then she does. And it's just really compelling. And it was kind of shocking because I'm not a huge Nick Cage fan, particularly, you know, the way that his career has evolved. I understand that he's done the Bruce Willis thing where he's made a bunch of really schlocky films because he wanted to make money or he needed to make money. I think he's actually still doing interesting creative work, but sometimes his over-the-topness really gets to me. Like, it's just not my bag. And this performance was something of all of that. And I ended up really coming around to it, particularly the Elvis inspired elements. Like, he is actually singing. This anticipates some of his later roles where he will embody Elvis in a more fulsome way. But even just the moment where they go to the concert and the dude hits on Lula and we get an almost greaser style 1950s, but it doesn't go the way that you think. And I really liked that we then transition into this Elvis song where we're actually incorporating audio from Elvis's concerts for the girls' reactions to show just how hot Sailor is. Like, that scene works so fucking well for me, and it really seemed to embody a lot of the creative impulses that Lynch was working with for the film.
Kind of continuing with this dissection of Nicolas Cage, I, too, am not the biggest fan. Like, I think, I mean, that's maybe a little bit too harsh. I do feel like looking at some of his filmography, particularly in the 2000s, he has moved into... I thought initially that maybe he was moving more into being a parody of himself.
Yes.
In some ways. But when I watched this movie, I was like, no, this has been him from the beginning.
He's been like this for a while.
Yeah, because I honestly cannot tell you the first Nicolas Cage movie I ever seen. I was aware of him more than I had ever seen him. Mm-hmm. And I'm literally going to have to go through IMDb and figure out what was the very first movie I saw him in, because I don't think it was until the late 90s that I was even cognizant of him as an actor outside of trailers and outside of like talk about him.
Yeah, I think mine was the very understated performance in It Could Happen to You with Marissa Tomei, where she wins the lottery. She's a waitress who wins the lottery and it changes her life, but he's a policeman who falls in love with her. And it's the most understated Nicolas Cage performance you'll ever see. But then, you know, you watch something like Moonstruck and you think, oh yeah, you know, he's been doing stuff like this for a while.
And the first movie that I probably was like cognizant of him as like an actor would have been The Rock.
Oh my god, yes. Yeah. And that is classic Nicolas Cage performance, right? Where he is the nerdy outsider amongst all of these Army SEAL guys, but also he's doing big things, right? And then he follows that up with something like Con Air, where he's an even bigger personality, like, put the bullet back in the box.
And see, I never saw Con Air. I think I've seen The Rock. I did not see Face Off. I have seen City of Angels, but like that right there, four movies where it is like, I think, cemented his persona on screen.
And also the box office prowess, right? Like, yeah, those films were giant.
And the thing that I always think about before, like, I started getting more involved into watching films, I think the whatever I would look at Nicolas Cage or see him, I would think of the trailer from Gone in 60 Seconds where he does, like, the finger thing. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
He's like, let's go.
And so for me, like, that is all I had ever associated Nicolas Cage with, was that moment from then on,
right?
Until I think we get to like an Adaptation, and I was like, he's doing some interesting stuff here. Like, he's had quite a career.
So much versatility. Yeah. Like, I mean, when I say I don't always love him, that's doing a big disservice to his filmography, because when you start to list them, I think, oh, wait, I do like a lot of these movies. I think it's just I'm so used to weird big swings from him that sometimes I don't know, like, I almost forget the more grounded performances. And something like Wild at Heart does a good job of balancing his eccentricities with his legitimate capacity to deliver a really good performance. Like, without him and Laura Dern, this movie is just filled with bananas secondary characters, and it's not a proper film.
No, you're absolutely right. And I do think Nicolas Cage benefits from a director that understands him. Mm, and so mm-hmm. I I do think when we get stuff like Adaptation, or we do get something like Wild at Heart, we can see his performance of the bigger than life performance that he sometimes brings to film, but it makes sense for what we're doing.
Yes. It matches the material.
Yes. And so like, I do think sometimes it feels like he's acting in a different movie from everyone else, but here in this particular film, it just works because he is, as you mentioned, filled to the brim and surrounded by bonkers characters that I'm like, who really? Fuck are these people?
Yeah, I mean, circling back around to some of the inherent struggle that we may have with the film, particularly on a first watch, I can't help but wonder if part of it is that some of this feels relatively grounded, and then other parts of it feel so outlandish and ridiculous. Like, I mentioned earlier how I thought that there's a little bit of timidness in 1990s audiences around the violence in particular. Like, the idea that people had a lot of issues with Johnny Farragut, aka the Harry Dean Stanton character, when he gets tortured. I found that scene not particularly remarkable. And yet apparently 80 to 100 people walked out of various theatrical performances of the film. So I just thought, okay, I mean, I think we were just in a different place in terms of cinematic violence, particularly in indie art scenes, but it's not as though those scenes are out of place in the rest of the film. And I think that's what I find surprising, is that this movie is operating at anywhere between about an 8 and a 12 at all times.
So I was thinking about, as you were talking about violence, I was thinking about this time period, because, you know, we have moved on from the 80s where the violence was over the top, but it was comical in a lot of ways, in a lot of mainstream movies, or it was goopy and it was set to like make you go like The Fly or The Thing, especially you go, ooh, that's kind of gross, as opposed to being confronted with violence that feels both grounded but also extreme in some ways, like this. Sure. And then a few years later, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, right? So we're at this time period, but then also on the video game side of things, Mortal Kombat premieres in 1992 and causes this whole discussion about violence in video games. And so I do think that the early 90s in particular was a lot of, well, somebody think of the children. What is happening? This is all horrifying. And so I do think that we have moved into a time period where people were, as you said, timid about the extreme sex, extreme violence, and that kind of aspect of it. So it's interesting.
Yeah, you know, now that you're saying it, because when you look up this film in particular, you do see a lot of comparisons to Reservoir Dogs. And that's 2 years after this film. That film also got into a lot of trouble for its violence, but I think it's because it was celebrated auteur status, right? So, you know, we weren't expecting this from indie sensations. And at the same time, I think Sex, Lies, and Videotape is 1990 as well. And that really starts a revolution in terms of depiction of sexuality on screen, which is not to say that any of this was actually new, right? We're talking about nearly 70 years of film history before this. Things had been provocative before, like, hello, go back to the 70s. It's all right there. But I think it's because of the time period, as you mentioned earlier, we're coming out of the 80s, which is this Reagan-era conservative family values, but also so much of it felt like it had to be hidden in either genre or satire. So as you were listing films, I was thinking, okay, what are some of the films that were really sensational in the 80s, but getting away with it because the message was hidden? And it's like RoboCop is the film that comes to mind. The movie is so fucking over the top, but you can wrap it in satire and say, oh, well, don't get your panties in a bunch about this.
Yeah, and even some of the, like, more commercial films, I'm thinking, like, Commando or, you know, it's all about military. And, you know, so I think it gets a pass because it's depicting war. It's depicting that kind of stuff. It's not depicting something that is happening in our front steps. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing I think people had issues with back with Texas Chainsaw Massacre first came out, of being you know, this is America and this is not a war movie. This is something that is happening here. And it's
this
horrifying.
Is America.
Exactly. And so I do think that probably has influenced the way in which people were, you know, looking at Reservoir Dogs or Wild at Heart or some of the kind of stuff coming out in those 90s, in the 90s. Mm-hmm.
Which is so funny to me, though. You know, we've said this film is grounded and sort of realistic, but it's also not at all, no. Right? Like the circumstances, even in the back half of the film, like I was actually really on board with the film, minus the Wizard of Oz stuff, until we end up in Tuna.
Big Tuna.
Big Tuna, yeah. Because even characters like Bobby Peru and the other people who are hanging around this kind of desert town, the feed store heist, which is sort of ridiculous, like, you know, it's going to go badly right from the get-go, obviously also very much anticipates Reservoir Dogs. It all feels very extreme, but not based in reality, even though this is just a standard heist.
Yeah, so I was also thinking about, I think part of the problem with road trip movies is that you're only as good as the stops along the way.
Yes.
And I also agree. I was mostly with the film until we get to Big Tuna. And even though Big Tuna gives us Willem Dafoe's horrifying and yet very provocative and kind of funny
teeth.
Those teeth performance as Bobby Peru, it definitely feels as if the movie has hit a wall in terms of pacing, and it feels like we've entered a different kind of movie
right
here at this point. And so I agree, I was with it up until that moment, but at the same time, these characters, I wanted to know more about a lot of them. I mean, we get Isabella right. Rossellini as Perdita for like two scenes.
Uh-huh. I could not figure out if it's meant to be her wearing a wig or if she just has bad roots, and I could yeah. not take my eyes off of her. But I mean, it's also Isabella Rossellini, and you just want more of her. Even, you know, we've not really mentioned, you said there's a fairly strong connection to previous Lynch collaborators and or Twin Peaks. So yeah, we've got Sherilyn Fenn as yeah. the girl in the accident. That sequence is fucking amazing. I loved it. Cheryl Lee, we've got Jack Nance as one of the people in Big Tuna. Grace Zabriskie as Juana Durango, I definitely wanted more of in this film.
Who was the last one?
So that's, she's the woman who tortures Johnny okay. Farragut.
Yes, I loved her. When she is first introduced behind, like, there's a screen and it's just a shadow uh-huh. and she is standing there.
She's
with
doing
her
like
cane
some Eartha Kitt voice.
Yes, and she has like this thick Nolans accent and mm-hmm. yes, giving me like Eartha Kitt vibes from that voice. Absolutely.
She's got a cane, one foot is shorter than the other, or one leg is shorter than the other. She's got a platform shoe. I was just like, what is this character?
I wanted more of her because she was such an interesting character to see on screen. And it was giving me so I was starting to wonder if Tammy Brown, the drag queen, was pulling from this performance, because there's a couple scenes in there with like the facial tics that she would do that I was like, this reminds me of Tammy Brown from Drag Race.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise, right? The interlocking between historical genre, cinema, and movie. I mean, it wouldn't surprise, right? Because the interlocking between film and various media and drag references is pretty storied. Like, queens who know yeah. their shit will often draw on stuff like this.
Absolutely.
And if they're not, babies, look at this film for motivation, because you have got characters to play with.
For days. For days.
So wild. Yeah. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head for me with the Big Tuna stuff, though, because so much of the rest of the film feels like there's an energy and there's a movement to it, right? Because we're in the car, we're driving, we're trying to outrun this team of assassins that have been set on our path. But then when we get to Big Tuna, we put down roots for the rest of the film. And it's not that it's not interesting. It's not like the characters that we encounter here aren't interesting, but it doesn't feel like it still has that forward momentum. And mm-hmm. also we're getting to the heavy stuff, right? Like, this is where we have to confront Lula's sexual assault and then her new sexual assault at the hands of Bobby Peru.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that scene between them, you know, like, content warning for basically a sexual assault. But when he is holding her and telling her that he wants her to say that she wants him to fuck her. There's something really hypnotic about that. Like, the way that Lynch frames it, but just leaves the two actors to play it, is enthralling.
Yeah, I couldn't look away. And normally when, like, a line is repeated ad nauseum, it sometimes can be off-putting for me. But yes. I was caught up in that moment.
Uh-huh.
It was confronting in the way in which it was very sexual, but at the same time, it was very inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to exactly discuss the scene, but it made me feel both, like, eroticized, but at the same time repulsed.
Yeah, you're turned on and also completely turned off because you understand that this is unwanted. And also, we know that she's pregnant. Bobby Peru does not know that. So it's almost, there's an extra layer to it that we as an audience are privy to. But then by the end of it, I mean, it does feel so seedy and sexual.
Yeah.
All this to say, you know, that could be a description of the entire film in a nutshell.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. We went into this conversation saying we don't really know how we're going to talk about the film. And I don't know that it's been wholly coherent if people haven't seen the movie. But I feel like we've actually touched on a lot of the things that really attracted and repulsed me about the film.
It definitely gave me, I think this conversation gave me a little bit more appreciation for what the film is trying to do in terms of looking at the 90s through a lens of the 50s, which is something that Lynch has done a number of times. And so I think there's some interesting things here. It also kind of established again or reestablished my thoughts that this movie doesn't wholly work for me.
Right.
But I went into this going, I don't know how long of a conversation we're going to have. And here we are, you know, getting to like almost 50 minutes. And I feel like we've said some interesting things about this film. I discovered some interesting things about this film.
Yeah, like I would really enjoy hearing from folks who either don't like this movie at all or who really like this movie. Because when you and I both said that we were doing first-time watches of this, I got a lot of comments from people who very clearly appreciate and or enjoy this movie. Like, hope you love it. It's my favorite Lynch film, so on, so on. And I was kind of shocked by that because in some ways, as we said, it feels very akin to his other work, but also pretty different.
I mean, I could see if particularly this might be your first Lynch film too, that there might be some kind of pull that this movie has because it is a lot different than the rest of his films. And so I would be curious to know if for people that really like this film, if this was their first Lynch watch, I would be curious about that as well.
Okay. Interesting.
Because it also, I mean, depending on the age of people that are going, this might be their first Lynch film because it's probably the most commercial of his films. So unless you were really seeking out, you know, weird cinema, you might not even be aware of Blue Velvet or anything before that.
Yeah, or it's maybe your second because you heard about Blue Velvet when it caused a big sensation, or you watch Twin Peaks and then you say, cool, I'm going to check out the new David Lynch.
Right.
And it's this.
Right.
All right. Well, Terry, why don't we leave it at that? If people want to tell us about their Wild at Heart experiences, how would they get in touch with you?
You will find me at Gailey Dreadful at wherever social media is currently existing. And Joe, if they want you to model that snakeskin jacket and see if you could pull it off in the way that Nick Cage could, where could they find you?
Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to suggest they wanted me to model his underwear. And I'm like, nope, I cannot pull that off. But yeah, some people would like to send me a snakeskin jacket to model. I can be reached at B stole my remote. That's the letter B. Oh, boy.
And be careful throwing that out there, Joe. You never know.
And we will thank the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network for hosting the show. But Terry, this is just the first episode back for our third season of the show. So we have plenty of mileage yet to go. We're going to jump back over to the David Cronenberg side next for a conversation that I don't know is going to be any more coherent because we're talking about the extremely what the fuckery of Naked Lunch.
Another first watch for both of us, and boy, what a film.
We have pre-recorded this episode because Wild at Heart proved a little more challenging for Terry to get his hands on, ironically enough. And yeah, I'm interested to see how the edit of the Naked Lunch episode comes together, because I think we both are on the struggle bus.
Yeah.
But you'll have to wait to hear how it comes together. We will be back in a couple of weeks to have that conversation. But until then, definitely sing your best Elvis tune, because you might just get the girls a-screaming.
The Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad.